You are listening to Iran Radio and Straightly. We go to the interesting facts about Islam. During the Golden Age of Islam, Muslims created a house of wisdom, or Baitul Hikmah, which was active during the 9th and 13th century, where both Muslims and non-Muslims scholars sought to translate the world's knowledge into Arabic. Many classic works of antiquity that might have otherwise been lost were preserved in Arabic and Persian and later translated into Turkish, Hebrew, and Latin. Here, scholars synthesized and significantly advanced knowledge gained from the Persian, Roman, Chinese, Egyptian, Greek, Byzantine and Phoenician civilizations. Muslim scholars like Ibn Rushd and Avicenna were primarily responsible for saving the works of prominent Greek philosopher Aristotle. We start off this hour's programs with Israel Watch. The program critically analyzes Zionist media reports about current events and issues in the West Asia region. They will be followed by dialogue. The program looks at the most important conversations between Shiite imams and their followers, questioners, and leaders of the other Islamic faith and sects. After that, we have our radio productions feature. And to round up this hour's programs, we have Ulema's speech. In this program, we broadcast excerpts from the speeches of well-known and reputable Islamic scholars.
Thank you for joining us. The repercussions of the clashes in the Syrian town of Beit Jinn, the escalating Israeli aggression against Lebanon, and the discussion taking place regarding the possibility of launching a war on Hezbollah, in addition to the issue of Palestinian resistance fighters in the Rafah tunnels. These topics will be the area of discussions in this episode with Mr. Khaled Barakat, writer and political researcher, joining us here in the studio. Hello and welcome, Mr. Khaled.
Thank you, Farah.
The Israeli assault on the town of Beit Jinn in the countryside of Damascus and the residents' confrontation with Israeli forces were the focus of many commentaries in the Hebrew media, which emphasized the need to maintain the occupation of Syrian territory. What's your opinion on what the Israeli commentator said that the forces, of course, he's saying that they should strengthen their own position inside Syria and not withdraw from it?
This just reflects the Israeli arrogance and the Israeli aggression. I mean, they have been bombing Syria regularly without any retaliation or even resistance. Yes. in Syria. But the Israelis are really surprised that there was a resistance because they tried to advance in the Syrian territory. So this is a colonizer who is shocked that the indigenous people of Syria are fighting back. They think that they can have a free hand in Syria and our region without any resistance. And in my view, we are going to witness an escalation in resistance in Syria on the borders, in the Syrian-Palestinian borders, against Israeli occupiers who have been advancing in Syrian land. And we are going to see this by Syrian popular resistance and armed resistance by the people of Syria. They have been seeing what Israel have been doing. And, more and more the Syrian public have been aware and there is an anger among Syrians.
Okay. But the major question asked here, Mr. Khaled, is that how would these incidents, whether the resistance, the appearance of the resistance and the Israeli continuation and deliberate act to control lands in Syria, affects the talks between Netanyahu and al-Julani?
Right. I think
with an American umbrella, under the American umbrella.
Absolutely. I mean, Israel doesn't want to give anything. They don't want to withdraw from Syrian land. They have been occupying the Golan Heights for, since 1967. And Trump said that he have given Golan Heights to Israel as a gift. I mean, this guy is worse than Balfour himself. And at the same time, we see that the people of Syria are actually being more and more aware of Israeli attempts and Israeli, plans on Syria. They want to plunder Syrian water, strategic areas like Jebel Sheikh, and elsewhere. But the most important thing is now this discourse is about the so-called extreme Sunnis. Extreme Sunnis for Zionists now is those who fight Israel back. You know, ISIS is not an extreme Sunnis. You know, these terrorist groups that have been killing Syrians bombing,
yes.
Civilians,
yes.
They're not extreme Sunnis. Extreme
okay.
Sunnis is the one who fight Israel.
Yes, but would it have an impact on the talks that are yet to be held and is being held under the table with an American support between Al-Junani and Netanyahu?
We are going to see.
These resistance, the appearance of the popular Syrian resistance.
You see, Farah, we are going to see two camps in Syria, just like we have two camps in Palestine and in Lebanon. Those who support the resistance and the liberation of their land, and those who are puppets to U.S. imperialism and to Israel. And we are going to see that this is imminent. It's not going to be like, because what does Syrian get out of a so-called peace accord?
So the talks are going to continue.
It's going to collapse.
It's going to collapse.
Absolutely. And if there is new Syrian regime going to have an... any kind of pact with Israel, it's mm-hmm. going to be a surrender to Israel.
Okay.
It's going to be a submission to Israel.
What is happening in Syria? Well, and Lebanon has pushed Iran to make an effort to deliver combat equipment to both countries and to Yemen as well to confront any new war that the Israelis may launch against Lebanon. According to this Israeli military commentator in the Hebrew media, how credible are these claims against Iran, that Iran is sending weapons to Syria, Lebanon, and Yemen? And what is the purpose of such allegations?
I mean, the Israelis are living in bubble, and they don't know how to leave this bubble. In fact, she made a mistake by saying, and they're supporting the Syrian regime, because they're used to saying these things in the past. And so it's in their mindset that Iran is arming, everyone. First of all, Iran public declared position that they support the resistance. It's something Iran is not shying away from.
Okay.
And so, when they say that, they're repeating the Israeli propaganda that the problem in the region is Iran, and that these resistance, whether in Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, they're just arms of Iran, proxies of Iran. And this is really have been exposed, internationally, that it is not true, and that the resistance in the region is one camp, but different components of it, mm-hmm. and the decisions that it's made is completely.
So, what's the purpose of forcing such allegations and implementing them, whether in the Hebrew media or even into Western media?
Because they're trying to build a camp against Iran, not just in Israeli camp against Iran, but also regional camp against Iran. Their eyes is fixed on. Threatening Iran, besieging Iran, imposing conditions, economic sanctions, and even war.
That's why I refer to Yemen to recruit Saudi Arabia.
Absolutely. And Saudis are actually, the Saudi regime have been launching aggressions against people in Saba regularly lately. Mm-hmm. And, I don't know what kind of commitment they got from the Saudi regime during the visit of Mohammed bin Salman to Washington, especially on the, deal of F-35 and these kind of, agreements between U.S. and Saudi Arabia. But I think that this is a rhetoric that we have been hearing for years.
Okay. Turning to Lebanon, the Hebrew media, of course, revealed the outcome of the security discussions that took place between the prime minister, the ministers, and the chief of staff regarding Lebanon following the recent aggression on the southern suburb of Beirut and the assassination of the martyr Tabtabai. According to what was revealed by the Hebrew media, the outcome of the Israeli security discussions regarding Lebanon boils down to the continuation of these attacks under an American green light. What do you see of that?
I think that the Israelis are divided, and I have been reading some of the Israeli military strategists who have been actually saying this out, directly, saying that there is a division within the Israeli military, ranks of how to deal with Lebanon. There are those who are pushing for a full-scale war, and those who are saying we can maybe escalate, but to a limit.
From the Israeli perspective, you're speaking,
yes.
Not the American one.
The Israelis.
Okay.
The Israelis. And I think that they are having a green light from the U.S., even if Israel escalates in Lebanon, because we know that the aggression against Lebanon is a U.S. aggression to begin with. This is really something that we cannot stress enough. To say that all of these...
But Trump's presenting himself that he wants peace in the Middle East,
yeah,
and that Lebanon has a special dimension to it, different from Palestine.
That, yeah, but
it does not seem that the Americans really want to do this.
Yeah, but if he doesn't want to do this, he won't give ultimatum to Lebanon saying December 31st, if you don't disarm, Hezbollah, then, there will be trouble. And then this is Trump rhetoric. But
so do you expect a full-scale war?
I don't think so. And the reason why I don't think that a full-scale war will happen is because Israel wants to keep the Lebanese public in this dilemma. Is there a war? Maybe there is no war. And at the same time, make everyone, worries. And so people are delaying their even personal plans,
Okay, yes.
And so at the same time, when you ask today in the Lebanese, public, they don't want to see a war. The vast majority of Lebanese don't want to see a war. But at the same time, Israel understands that a full-scale war means that all the efforts they did in the north in resettling their settlers are going to be just collapsing.
Okay.
And that the resistance is ready, and it's have been declaring that if an aggression, especially land, invasions.
Yes.
Lebanon,
okay, but Mr. Khaled, how do you read the timing of the Pope's visit to Lebanon? Would it make the war less likely, large-scale war by Israel on Lebanon?
Israel doesn't care about the Pope. This is the last thing in their mind. They actually don't like his statements about even the two-state solution. And they're just refraining from criticizing the Pope because they know that, they might lose more on international, front. But at the same time, we see that Israel is more and more isolated.
Yes, but the visit shows that the Lebanon has a special place.
It is.
For Christians, especially.
Absolutely.
Yes. Wouldn't that cause more pressure on Israel if a large-scale war is to be done?
And we want the Pope also to recognize that Palestinians, a great portion of our people, are Christians, and that Christ himself was Palestinian, and that Israel kills Christians every, regularly in
churches.
Palestine, and attack churches, and steal, sites by Palestinian Christians. And it is really important for the Pope to actually see that these crimes and genocide, Israel cannot get away with it. I mean, they destroy four historical churches in Gaza. They have killed and injured and, displaced, the vast majority of Christians in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's absolutely known now to, if I may use the Christians, across the globe, that Israel is a genocidal regime, that Israel is very dangerous to Muslims and Christians in our region.
But yet it's harshly been criticized.
Actually, there is a division. There are hundreds of churches across the globe.
Okay.
They understand what Israel is all about.
The issue of the presence of Palestinian resistance fighters in the Rafah tunnels in the Gaza Strip continues to draw media attention in the Israeli entity, especially as it comes amid calls within the entity to deal with them by military means. Do you think that the issue of the Palestinian resistance fighters in Rafah will take a political path or only a military path?
I think what Israel wants to do is to create create an image where they are victorious. They have been proposing for fighters to come out with white flags to submit their arms. Behind the doors, and I know this solid information, it's not analysis,
mm-hmm.
that the Israelis just wanted to have this image of Palestinian fighters surrendering. And they cannot get this image. They have been trying to get this, victory image for over 2 years, and they couldn't. And so the resistance is not going to give them now this opportunity. And that's
okay.
why they're upset. That's why they're angry. They're angry because, yes, they detained some of them. They killed some of them. They don't respect, we're supposed to have a ceasefire,
mm-hmm.
and yet they are bombing.
And they made promises that these tunnels has been conquered,
yes.
to their own people, and now they're in another position. To what extent do you believe that there is Israeli fear of the resistance fighters and the possibility of that they could attack the occupation forces that are next to the tunnels or close to the tunnels?
These fighters were there in these positions because they were in the advanced positions. Basically, they're fighters who have been determined to fight until the last bullet. So they will not surrender. Israeli army are afraid of getting closer and closer to some of these tunnels. The Palestinian resistance in Gaza is willing to fight if any Israeli intrusion comes to the tunnels. These tunnels are completely full of explosives. If Israelis, soldiers or, battalions try to infiltrate in these tunnels, they will go into face consequences.
Okay.
And they're trying to do it slowly, the Israelis, but surely. At the same time, some of the Hamas leaders' sons have been killed recently in these tunnels. So they're trying to put pressure on the negotiating team of Hamas to say that, we will, use this as a pressure point
okay.
to get more concessions from the resistance.
Okay. However, Israeli social media reacted to the ongoing Israeli aggression against the occupied West Bank, and here are some of the comments.
News 24. Five Stones is the name of the operation launched by army forces in Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, to thwart terrorist acts there. Shlomo Reichman. Terrorism in Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, has become organized and systematic. There are battalions with command and control that threaten the Israeli army's freedom of action in the area. Adi Rotem, Finance Minister Smotrich has no interest in the economy. All that matters to him is the gradual annexation of Judea and Samaria, the West Bank.
And regarding the disagreements between Israeli Minister of War, Israel Katz, and Chief of Staff Eyal Zamir, which continue to dominate political and media debates within the Israeli entity over who bears responsibility for the emergence of these disagreements at this time. One of the most notable aspects to these agreements is that they are occurring amid a militarily and politically aggressive trajectory, whether in Lebanon, in Gaza, or even in Syria. What does this indicate?
It indicates, again, that the Israeli don't have a strategy. They have a might supported by the United States. They are bombing, but they cannot have really, what's the end game? What do they want from Syria? What do they want from Lebanon, from Gaza? If you ask them this question.
Greater Israel.
Yes, but that's what Netanyahu says, in the open. But really,
they don't have a plan, you're saying?
What I mean is that, this is a war criminal who's wanted by the International Criminal,
Court. Yes.
And at the same time, Israel is isolated. We need to always remember that Israel today is not Israel before October 7th. And, these kind of policies and positions and fractions, it just indicates not Israel's strength, but Israel weakens, And I just give you two quick examples. One, we have been seeing the migration, the opposite migration from Israel, Israelis.
Mm-hmm.
The tech communities, particularly the young people, are leaving.
But not enough light is shed on that.
Yes. And I think because there is not really solid information in numbers. But in the best case scenario for Israelis, we're talking about in the hundreds of thousands of Israelis who have either left or in the process of leaving. Why would Israeli settlers who are enjoying all these privileges would leave? They leave because Netanyahu keeps talking about an endless wars. I mean, greater Israel means tomorrow probably wars with Egypt, probably with
Iraq,
and you know, and so, and this is
Saudi Arabia is included too.
Threatening the even those who signed deals and peace accords with Israel, and I think that the Israeli strategy is there is no Israeli strategy. This is not Israel that we know for 7-8 decades. This is an entity that doesn't know its path. They don't know what they want. And you watch Israeli media or you read Israeli press and you see that very clearly. They're divided and fascist Israeli settler gangs, you know, in the West Bank, they see that this is an opportunity for them to escalate against Palestinians.
Okay. Unfortunately, our time is up. Mr. Khaled Barakat, writer and political researcher, thank you very much for joining us in this episode.
The whole world is silent towards oppression. Even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
We have to have a very fair assessment of this academic and intellectual icon of early Islam.
His impact is more pronounced in jurisprudence that he formalized.
And tens of thousands of statements and teachings have reached us from Al-Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam.
This is Dialogue, an introduction to the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today, we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the history of Islam, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. The sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Jafar al-Sadiq alayhi salam, was an incredibly prominent character in the history of the Muslims. He benefited humankind with his highly scientific achievements, many of which had never been seen before by humanity. Imam Jafar al-Sadiq alayhi salam's instructions in the acts of worship and transactions and his contribution in the field of legislation were amazing achievements that had not occurred before amongst the Muslim masses. And his eminence also had a positive and active share in the establishment of human culture and civilization. the sixth divinely appointed Imam, the son of Imam Baqir alayhi salam, an individual who was divinely appointed by the Almighty Allah, was known to have improved the general public lives of the people and the Muslims, and he was an individual, a divinely appointed Imam, a man from the household of the Holy Prophet, who enhanced human thoughts and discovered many of the secrets of this universe. Welcome back, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam. So there is a contemporary of the era of Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, the sixth divinely appointed Imam. This contemporary's name is Abdul Karim ibn Abil Auja. Now, I'm not really sure what religious background is that of this individual, Abdul Karim ibn Abil Auja. But apparently, when you look at the historical evidence, he was not just an unbeliever or an infidel, but he was much worse than that, apparently. He also was well known to have spread moral corruption amongst the Muslim masses, and he also apparently openly waged vehement wars against Islam. This contemporary of Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam by the name of Abdul Karim ibn Abil Auja. Now, again, I wasn't able to figure out, you know, what his religious background was. Was he a Muslim? Was he a Christian? Was he a Jew? I'm not really sure. It's not clear. But what is clear is that apparently he has been called as being worse than an unbeliever, and he has been called as being worse than an infidel. And again, as we very humbly stated, that it is also reported historically that he was spreading moral corruption, ethical corruption, decadence amongst the Muslims. That's also really bad, and of course, he was openly waging some kind of wars against Islam. Now, what we find is really interesting is that this kind of an individual, you know, who is historically known to be a bad person, committing these kind of sins on this kind of level, there's really no good expected from this kind of an individual. But it's interesting, and really it's amazing, and perhaps even one could say it's a miracle. We find that when somebody asked him about Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, and apparently somebody was bad-mouthing or disrespecting Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, and this individual, Abdul Karim ibn Abil Auja, he, you know, very vehemently or very strictly, he responds back, and he says that no, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, Ja'far ibn Muhammad, is not a mere human being. Ja'far ibn Muhammad is such a spiritual being who could be a human being if he wished, and he could be a spiritual being if he wished. I mean, what an amazing thing that this individual has said. And what makes it even more amazing is the fact that the individual was so evil and so corrupt, and despite being so evil and so corrupt, he was, you know, putting forth this evidence, and he was stating openly this incredible spiritual excellence of the sixth divinely appointed Imam. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam. IRIB English Radio, our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now let's listen to Sayyid Muhammad Jawad Al-Ghazwini.
Another beautiful, amazing lesson from the Imam alayhi salam, and this one's really relevant in our era. The Imam alayhi salam teaches us that our appearance, our looks, is a great means of trial in this dunya. It's a trial in two ways. One way are those people who are not satisfied with their looks. They're not happy with their looks. They hate their looks, they hate their body. And this applies to our younger generation. One of the causes of suicide, depression, anxiety amongst teenagers and people in their 20s is that they're unhappy with their looks. I'm unhappy with my body. I hate this body. I hate these looks. And so this hadith from the Imam alayhi salam states, and al-Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, يُؤْتَى بِالْمَرْأَةِ الْحَسْنَاءِ يَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ. On the day of judgment, a woman who has been deemed as being beautiful is brought on the day of judgment. أَلَّتِي قَدْ افْتُتِنَتْ فِي حُسْنِهَا. She failed her trial because of her looks. She deceived men because of her looks. She fell into haram because of her looks. She felt arrogant because of her looks. So on the day of judgment, Allah holds her accountable. Now she is smart, you know, women are smart, mashallah. She defends herself before God on the day of judgment. What does she say to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? She says, Ya Rab, hassanta khalqi hatta laqitu ma laqit. Oh Allah, you gave me my good looks. And that's why I had this trial. So she's trying to tell Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you know, you gave me this power, you gave me good looks, and unfortunately, I failed my trial. But you gave me those looks. It seems from the hadith she's trying to blame God or deflect blame from herself. What does Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tell her? The response comes from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. فَيُجَاءُ بِمَرْيَمْ عَلَيْهَا السَّلَامُ فَيُقَالُ أَنْتِ أَحْسَنْ أَوْ هَذِهِ قَدْ حَسَّنَّاهَا فَلَمْ تُفْتَتَنْ. Allah will bring Maryam alayhi salam, Mary, the mother of the Christ. Allah will tell this lady, are you more beautiful or Maryam? Maryam, by the way, was known for her beauty. She was one of the most beautiful women of her time. Allah will tell this lady, look at yourself. Are you more beautiful or Maryam? We gave her beautiful looks, but she did not fail her trial. She protected her modesty and chastity and her humbleness. She's a hujjah on you on the day of judgment. Beautiful lesson that you learn from Al-Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Dialogue. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
You raise your tired hands toward the sky, and the dark night lights up as you praise God. Your tears rain on your hijab and this cold air is filled with the fragrance of jasmine flower. Come and walk again in our troubled streets and lanes, and heal the scars of our your door and you give him your necklace and the only food in your home. You talk to God until the rising of the sun and you forget yourself while praying.
On September 22, 1980, when the Islamic Revolution of the Iranian people was not yet 2 years old, Saddam attacked Iran with the green light from the U.S. The former Iraqi dictator has signed a peace agreement with Mohammad Reza Pahlavi 5 years earlier, which had ended his border disputes with Iran. But just a few days before issuing the order to attack, much like the U.S. president who tore up the JCPOA agreement, he appeared openly and confidently on television and declared all his commitments with Iran null and void. Forty-five years later, with a 12-day imposed war, all these memories were revived for Iranians. This time, with America's green light, Benjamin Netanyahu, instead of Saddam, attacked Iran at a moment when indirect negotiations between Tehran and Washington were underway to supposedly resolve Iran's nuclear file peacefully. Now the entire world was waiting to see whether, just as Iranians under the guidance of their leader in the 8-year war with Saddam managed to force the enemy into accepting a ceasefire and defeat, in the second imposed war, the Israeli regime and its supporters would also be compelled to retreat or not. The Israeli regime's assessment was that, given Iran's chronic economic problems and social divisions, after a lightning military strike, spontaneous protest cells would emerge, and what happened in Syria would be repeated in Iran as well. Thus, it was that June 13th marked the beginning of a difficult time for Iranians. According to the planners of this attack, with the assassination of high-ranking generals, the situation in Iran would become so chaotic that higher groups and counter-revolutionaries could seize control of parts of Tehran, such as Mehrabad Airport and its surrounding areas, from the police and security forces. This was deemed to cause the conditions. Through street chaos, special forces would be airlifted into Iran, pushing the structure of Iran's government to the brink of collapse within a matter of days. The name of this operation had already been determined, True Promise 3. In line with operations True Promise 1 and 2, the IRGC in its first missile response did exactly what the regime had anticipated, using a large number of missiles so that the Israelis would feel assured that Iran's missile response pattern had not changed. The Israeli army assumed that by Iran's numerous launches, the locations of its missile systems would be exposed, and subsequently, under aerial strikes, another portion of the Islamic Republic's missile capability could be destroyed.
But we've not seen the pictures of it and been able to assess the nature of the damage because Israeli sensors have blocked that. But we also know that Iran hit and damaged, and in some cases destroyed, the Israel's version of the Pentagon, Israel's version of the CIA, Israel's version of the FBI, Israel's version of the National Security Agency. Israel has two seaports where containers come into the country and where exports leave the country. Iran shut those down. So wow. There was no more seatime, maritime traffic coming in and out of the port. Iran also destroyed the two oil refineries or interrupted their ability to process and produce fuel, the oil refineries at Haifa and Ashdod, which is also the places where the ports are located. Iran shut down the only international airport in Israel. So nobody was getting in and out of the country unless they went to a military airfield and got out on a military aircraft. But all of the military airfields in Israel were also hit.
I'm actually, it's more of a town, really, just on the outskirts of Tel Aviv called Rishon Zion. I am surrounded right now. If I look in every direction, there are a crew of about 12 emergency workers just in front of me now going patrolling houses everywhere around the streets here. There's the detritus of the strikes that happened at 5 a.m. this morning in this neighborhood. And just around the corner from me is what is now a crater, which used to be homes, where two people died.
But that was not the whole story. Israel's costly and expensive attacks carried out with repeated NATO aircraft refueling in the skies not only wore down equipment, but also imposed numerous financial, security, and logistical constraints on Israel and its allies. For this reason, contrary to the bluffs of the Zionist officials, this war was supposed to end very quickly with a decisive victory. Yet Iran, by changing its defensive tactics, decided that, contrary to the enemy's design, the war should become long and attritional, so that Israel would be punished by accepting defeat and a ceasefire would be dictated to them.
Iran has stood up against it. Iran has the admiration and respect of the entire Arab world. The people in the Arab world that are not respected, that everybody loathes, are the ruling elites, because they are seen as eagerly selling everybody out for money and stability. So this war is going to continue for that reason. The other reason is that you can't leave Iran in place if you're an Israeli, because you've determined that they cannot be subjugated. If they can't be subjugated, if they won't submit to Israeli supremacy, inevitably they're going to come back and threaten Israel.
You get what Israel got, and basically, I don't know, they probably will not recover from this, at least in any time soon, if ever, actually. And you look attentively at some quarters of Tel Aviv or Beersheba, or it's just freaking like World War III there.
Iran's missile responses were so effective and unexpected that they quickly alarmed the West about Israel's imminent defeat.
Amaltis.
Thus, on the fourth and fifth days of the war, the leaders of the G7 gathered to take action in support of Israel. From that moment, it became clear that if the U.S. did not directly enter the field, Israel would be buried under the weight of Iran's missile strikes. For the White House, a strange situation arose. On the one hand, the fragile state of America's energy market, economy, and security was such that it could not enter into an intense war with Iran. On the other hand, could not remain indifferent to the heavy blows that were pressuring its most important proxy force in the region. Therefore, in a historic gamble fraught with uncertainties, it decided to attack the nuclear facilities at Natanz, Fordo, and Isfahan. Immediately after this incident, Trump threatened Iran with consequences if it responded in any way and declared the time for a ceasefire and the end of the war had arrived.
And, you know, I listened to President Trump not too long ago say that Israel is winning. And, of course, this is the mantra in the mainstream media. But the question you have to ask yourself is, what does winning mean? It's a meaningless comment by itself.
If under these circumstances, Iran had accepted a ceasefire, the United States would have succeeded in pulling Israel honorably out of the quagmire of war with Iran. But shortly after the U.S. Army's attack, Iran once again targeted Israeli-occupied territories with intense and devastating strikes. This time, the IRGC both changed its firing pattern and unleashed a large, energetic barrage upon Israel. Releasing images of widespread destruction in occupied territories evoked the Israeli army's assaults on Gaza. But the IRGC's missile campaign was not yet over. On the evening of June 23rd, the armed forces of the Islamic Republic carried out a precise attack named Bishadat al-Fath, glad tidings of victory against the Al Udeid base in Qatar, using the same number of projectiles that the U.S. had employed in its strike on Iran's nuclear facilities. Although the Islamic Republic did not use its new generation missiles in this attack, the Americans, despite conducting the largest Patriot air defense operation in history, still failed to intercept all of the projectiles. In the end, 6 out of the 14 missiles launched hit their targets. The Al Udeid base in Qatar is considered the most valuable strategic asset of the U.S. military in the region and serves as the headquarters of CENTCOM's Air Command. Alongside the operations True Promise 3 and Glad Tidings of Victory, the network of espionage and sabotage agents inside Iran, which had cost years of investment in training, equipping, and organizing, was being destroyed through vigilance of the people and the efforts of the Basij, security, and law enforcement forces. At the same time, the extraordinary cohesion of Iranians elevated the social capital of Iran to its highest point, and under the guidance of the commander-in-chief, public demands for punishing the aggressor grew stronger. Simultaneously, the measures of state officials to manage affairs and coordinate with the armed forces constantly conveyed to the world the message that Iran, united and in one voice, was ready for a long and powerful defense of its country. It was at this point that the regime had to find a solution for this dire situation. The intensity of the attacks and repeated crossing of red lines, such as targeting places like Evin Prison and medical centers on the 11th day, was for this reason.
Well, the thing you want to remember is that the Israelis depend very heavily on the idea or the notion that they have military superiority over everybody in the region, that they are invincible. And if they start a war and they lose that war, they don't win that war, and indeed it looks like Iran wins the war, this is a significant defeat for Israeli deterrence. It's just something that's almost unthinkable. They started this war thinking that they were going to win a relatively easy victory, and they were going to do to Iran what has been done to Syria. But that's not going to happen. The Iranians are going to stay in this fight. You want to remember that Iran fought against Iraq for 8 years, from 1980 to 1988.
Man, those days we were on Iraq's side, right?
That's correct. So the Iranians, I think, will stay in the fight. And I don't think Israel can maintain this fight over the long term.
By now, the enemies of the Iranian nation were grasping for breath, especially under the weight of global condemnations, which, with the fatwas of great religious authorities, such as Grand Ayatollah Sistani, further tightened the pressure on the U.S. and Zionist regime. If Iran's attacks on occupied territories had continued, if Iranian missiles had targeted other U.S. military bases in the region, if the oil and economic interests of the West had been damaged, if resistance groups in the region, who throughout these 12 days had kept their fingers on the trigger, such as Yemen, had entered the field, and if the energy economy and trade in the Persian Gulf had been disrupted, then what achievement would remain for the supporters of aggression against Iran? It was precisely for this reason that Washington, in a state of panic through intermediaries, proposed an immediate ceasefire to Iran. On June 23, 2025, the second imposed military war against the Islamic Republic of Iran came to an end after 12 days. Although from the very first hours of accepting the ceasefire proposed by the West, the war of narratives began, aiming to portray Israel and the U.S. as victors, awaken consciences, and above all, the people of the region and the Iranian nation knew who the true winner of Iran's struggle against the entire world of domination was.
It has taken Israel's high command just 12 days to see that total victory they claim to have achieved in the first hours of their blitz on Iran turn something that looks much more like a strategic defeat. This 12-day war ended with none of Israel's three war aims being met. Trump's claim that Iran's nuclear enrichment program had been completely and fully obliterated has within a day been flatly contradicted by the intelligence arm of the Pentagon, who sent in the B-2 bombers.
The reason you had a 12-day war was first and foremost because the Israelis were running out of missiles, running out of the means to defend themselves.
Yeah.
Israel was being crushed in one barrage after another of very accurate and devastating missile fire from...
Iran hasn't been defeated. In fact, Iran has punched back very hard against Israel, and Iran still has the ability to intimidate the United States.
Beyond. But no, Israel is not a regional military hegemon and cannot dictate the future shape of the Middle East. The price it has had to pay is high. It has swapped Hamas's homegrown rockets for Iran's ballistic missiles. It has swapped an indirect enemy who uses proxies for a direct one, which has now no hesitation in keeping the entire population of Israel in its bunkers. Netanyahu's lifelong dream of slaying the Iranian dragon may have proved to be a bridge too far.
At the end of these 12 days, Israel not only failed to achieve its initial declared objectives of causing the collapse of Iran's governance, but the military power of Iran, which was supposed to be destroyed, turned into its bane. The U.S. success in destroying Iran's nuclear facilities was also met with serious doubt from experts
due to the ambiguous and meaningful silence of the Iranian officials. Thus, the disgraceful and historic memory of the White House's cooperation with the aggression of the Israeli regime was this time etched into history with their failure to achieve their declared goals. Now, the Israeli regime, with its long list of war crimes, such as attacks on ambulances, rescue teams, and medical centers, assaults on scientific and research institutions, assassinations of scientists, intimidation of civilians, and attacks on media centers such as IRIB and the Central Building of Islamic Radio and Television Union, awaits the consequences of what it has committed. And the U.S., with its lost prestige due to insults and offenses against diplomatic values, stands dishonored with its shattered grandeur at the hands of the Iranians. Meanwhile, along with a sense of pride and the rising spirit of sacrifice among the people, it is the flag of honor and dignity of the Islamic Republic of Iran that has been raised high through the readiness of its sons for struggle across the world, even though in this celebration of victory, we miss many great and small heroes of the homeland.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant fact.
Imamat yek asle zinda.